Welcome to the St. Andrew's Sunday Morning Sermon Podcast. No matter who you are, where you've been, what you believe, or whether you believe anything at all, you are welcomed here. I'm Reverend Mark Feldmeyer, St. Andrew's Senior Pastor, and I'm glad you're here. There are many ways to connect with St. Andrew's community from wherever you happen to be. If you're interested in learning more about St. Andrew, I'll be mentioning some ways to connect with us at the end of today's podcast. Let's take a moment now to hear this week's scripture reading before we jump into today's message.
This morning, our reading presents itself from the Gospel according to Mark. It's my favorite gospel, I have to say that. But it concludes in silence, lacking the customary hallelujah, and surprisingly, it is devoid of Jesus' appearance at the end. Mark portrays Jesus' Galilean ministry with displays of great power, but also a little bit of confusion, even among his closest disciples. In this way, Mark's gospel addresses those who never witnessed Jesus firsthand, inviting his readers and all of us to inhabit the realm between absence and potential. Hear now these words from the Gospel according to Mark, chapter 16, verses 1 through 8. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, brought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They had been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb?" And when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He is not here. Look, there is the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you." So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. May God add a blessing to the reading of this word.
Well, friends, welcome to Easter Sunday, the most inspiring and transcendent, yet most confusing and convoluted Christian holiday ever humanly conceived. Now, we all love Easter, no doubt, with all of its promise of hope and new life and God's unconquerable love, even in the face of death. But don't you find it a little weird sometimes how over the centuries it's become this really odd mashup of Christian tradition and American commercialization. I love chocolate bunnies and baby chicks as much as the next guy, and I'm super down with Easter baskets and colored eggs and jelly bellies and honey-baked hams and Cadbury cream eggs, and I'm even okay with grown adults dressing up in bunny costumes and dropping eggs in some neighbor's backyard. Only on Easter, though. Any other day, it's going to get you arrested, okay? But I'm still wondering how any of these things and what any of these things have to do with the resurrection of Jesus. I mean, it's almost like centuries ago, the Willy Wonka and the Pope were at some crazy party. And at some point after midnight, one of them turned to the other and said, "You know, we really should work together sometime." But Easter is even more confusing than that, because Apparently, those two stayed way too late at that party. And after working out all the consumer details of Easter, they went straight to scheduling. And that's when they brought in, of all people, an astronomer who had this crazy idea to move the date of Easter every year just to mess with us. And he's like, hey, I've been thinking, instead of assigning Easter a fixed date on the calendar like Christmas, how about we mix it up a little bit, right? And schedule it every year on, I don't know, just thinking out loud, maybe the first Sunday after the first full moon that follows the spring equinox. Perfect, right? And so here we are celebrating the resurrection of Christ on the first Sunday after the first full moon of the spring equinox, with our honey-baked hams at home in our ovens and all of our kids sugar buzzing on yellow peeps and jelly bellies. It makes perfect sense, doesn't it? But if you're wondering, that imaginary party actually happened at some point in the 8th century. And that is when the Christian church made this decision to celebrate the resurrection of Christ by adopting an ancient German springtime festival called Eostra. Eostra celebrated the rebirth of spring and fertility and reproduction. And its symbol was a rabbit, a cute little furry mammal with super impressive reproductive capabilities. And Eostra became Easter. And its symbol, the rabbit with its legendary procreative capacities, became, you guessed it, the Easter bunny. Now, if the reproduction theme of Eostra sounds like a major departure from the resurrection theme of Easter, maybe it can at least be an entryway into understanding what we're actually doing here today, which is to proclaim that life prevails and love wins, that even though Jesus was crucified, Christ is alive, and that even as we, like Jesus, contend daily with the powers of death in this world, we can proclaim that God's purposes will not be defeated. And the message of Easter is that death is very real, but life doesn't end. It just changes. And so if that's true, we can go on, despite whatever bleak stuff life throws at us, believing that in the end, everything will be just as it should be. Everything is going to be okay. The Brazilian writer Fernando Sabino put it this way: in the end, everything will be okay. And if it's not okay, it's not yet the end. And that's the Easter message. Everything in the end will be okay. Not okay as in good enough, or as in just fine, but could be better, but okay as in it's all right. It is as it should be. Everything in the end will be okay. And yet I wonder if that claim that everything's going to be okay, if that's actually what keeps most people disbelieving in the Easter story. As hard as it is for us reasonable, smart, scientifically minded people to wrap our minds around the idea that a dead man could come back to life, I actually think it's harder, way harder, for modern people like you and me to accept the claim that everything in the end will be okay. It's not that we don't want to believe that's true. I mean, we all want everything to be okay, but maybe like the disciples of Jesus who witnessed firsthand the brutal crucifixion of their best friend on Good Friday, it can be pretty hard for us to believe that everything's going to be okay when we look at our own lives sometimes and it feels like we're losing our grip and things are out of our control and the future feels so uncertain and doesn't feel like anything will ever be okay again. Or maybe like those disciples of Jesus who contended daily with the Roman Empire and the injustices of the empire, maybe we look at our world sometimes and all we see is bad news. The bad news of Good Friday everywhere. Gaza, Ukraine, ecological disasters, economic disparities, racism, hunger, poverty, disease. You know, when we're really honest about what's going on with the world, Sometimes it's hard to believe that everything is going to be all right. In fact, it might for some even seem that the opposite is true, that everything is just getting worse. In fact, if you belong to Generation Z, studies suggest you feel this despair over life and the world even more acutely than others. It's called existential anxiety. 6 in 10 young Americans between the ages of 12 and 27 see issues like climate change and AI and student debt as existential threats to their future. And to them, they report universally, like it feels like it's getting worse, not better. But I wonder if that's mostly because of our modern worldview, that is, how we see the world. Ever since the scientific revolution about 400 years ago, you and I have been taught, indoctrinated actually, to believe that we live in this mechanistic universe where everything we experience and see, including ourselves, is really just one part of this big soulless machine. And that we and all the other individual parts of the universe are here just for one purpose, which is to keep the big machine running. We're just, in other words, another cog, a pulley, a lever, a gear in the system. We're just here to do our jobs and play our part, keep it all running until we finally break down too, and we just get replaced by another part. Now, maybe you don't see the world this way, but have you ever said, man, it feels like I've just been grinding away lately? Or man, life can be such a grind. Have you ever said at work or at school, I just feel like another cog in the wheel sometimes? Or has anybody ever asked you how you're doing and you say, just plugging away, just cranking away? Have you ever noticed how we describe human emotion? We say things like, that guy just flipped a gasket. What gasket, right? Or wow, she just blew a fuse. Or man, I'm feeling really gassed. Why do we refer to ourselves and conceive of ourselves as machinery? Maybe it's because we've been taught, indoctrinated, that we live in a mechanistic universe where there are no subjects, there are only objects or things. And where in those things there is no soul or spirit, it's just molecules and atoms. And where in those atoms there's no meaning or purpose or anything beyond its sheer utility to the system. And where eventually this matter breaks down. And when matter breaks down, it just doesn't matter anymore. This is how we see our world. It's just a bunch of soulless, spiritless parts of a machine, where we live for a brief time, and we play our part until we break down and we pass on, and that's that. And if that's the worldview that we subscribe to, isn't that a hopeless storyline for history? Isn't it no wonder that so many people today live without hope or purpose or joy, without any concern for the world's problems, without any compassion for themselves or others? And Easter comes around and it says, no, that's not true. There's no denying that death is real. It happens for all of us, just as it happened for Jesus. But we are not objects in a machine. We are subjects, says Easter. We are subjects in God's unfolding story. And Easter says that, man, there is something enduring beyond our utility that suggests that life doesn't end. It just changes. We know this intuitively, biologically. Our bodies are constantly undergoing change. While we are alive, our bodies never stop dying and renewing themselves. We are constantly changing and renewing and becoming more in this moment than we were in the last. In fact, right now, there are about 35 to 40 trillion cells occupying your body right now. And those cells are not all the same cells that you had yesterday. Over time, some cells get old and tired, others self-destruct for reasons we can't explain, but all those cells are highly efficient at replicating themselves to the tune of about 330 billion cells that are new every day of your life. And some cells work on a much shorter timeline than others. White blood cells, for example, replace themselves about every 3 days. Red blood cells about every 4 months. Skin cells about every 2 weeks. Bone cells about every 10 years. Brain cells, I'm sorry to say, do not regenerate at all, which explains a lot, doesn't it? And fat cells, unfortunately, those stick around for about 12 to 50 years, which confirms the scientific accuracy of the phrase stubborn belly fat, right? But the truth is undeniable. We are not unchanging, unchangeable objects. We are constantly dying, constantly experiencing the world, constantly becoming something new in every moment. And what Easter says is this process of becoming something new never ends, even after our bodily life does. Not just a bunch of soulless, spiritless objects in a machine after all. Something lives on and becomes more until finally it becomes exactly what God intended it to be all along and everything is all right. And we don't know how this works. All we know is that, sadly, it requires some kind of dying or letting go. And on that first Good Friday, a man was laid in a tomb. His name was Jesus. He was dead. And he had died on a cross. His body was laid in a tomb. A stone was set in place over the opening of the tomb, and none of that was ever questioned. But beyond those details, there are a lot of unanswered questions, like who rolled away the stone, and what happened to the body, and where in the world is Jesus? And I just think it's a gift that these questions remain unanswered, because Easter was never meant to be about gathering all the facts to prove scientifically that there was a bodily resurrection 2,000 years ago. Easter is all about how each of us, like Jesus, are moving from life to death to new life, becoming different and new the next moment, until finally we become what God intended us to be. It's about everything that really is going to be okay in the end, just as it was for Jesus. It's about how God's purposes to make something, everything right, will never end. Someday all of us and all of this will be as God intended it to be. This doesn't give us a free pass to let things work themselves out in the world on their own. It doesn't give us a free pass to not get involved in the world's problems to make things better now. In fact, in the Easter story, the disciples are given a mission. The mission is to go and tell others, says the stranger, that everything's going to be okay in the end. Have you ever noticed sometimes that just walking into spaces that are troubled or people who are in crisis, and to be able to say with authenticity, everything's going to be okay in the end, have you ever noticed how sometimes it makes everything okay in the moment? And that's our mission, to help make things right in this moment, in our time, in our world. And we don't have to wait for God to make everything all right. We can actually cooperate right now with God's purposes to make the world as right as possible right now. And so Easter asks us the great question, how do you want to make the world right? And what matters most to you, and are you willing to live for it? We'll close with this. So Paul Kalanithi's book, When Breath Becomes Air, became a national bestseller. Kalanithi was a surgeon in Stanford. At 38 or 36 years old, he was diagnosed with a metastatic lung cancer. He died a year later. But over that course of that year, he wrote a memoir about his journey through illness and his quest for meaning. And he writes about how upon his diagnosis, he wanted to know how much time he had left. As a scientist, he was well-versed in the survival curves for various diseases, but now he was a patient. And he demanded from his oncologist to give it the straight answer on how much time he had left, and she refused. Every time he pressed her, she said the same thing. She said, I can't tell you a time. You have got to find out what matters most to you and live for it. And those words changed his life. They kept him from waiting for the inevitable or dwelling on his illness. And they emboldened him to forge a new future in the time that he had left. And every day he reminded himself, find what matters most to you and live for it. And as he began to figure that out, he and his wife one day were talking about maybe having a child. And the wife asked out loud, maybe having a child would make his death more painful. And his response to that was beautiful. He said, wouldn't it be great if it did? Takeaways for today. God's purposes will not be defeated. Something in all of us lives on. You find out what matters most to you and you live for that, and everything in the end will be all right.
Thanks for tuning into this week's podcast. If you'd like to be connected to learn more about our St. Andrew community, or would like to financially support our work, including this weekly sermon podcast, I invite you to visit gostandrew.com or email us at connect@gostandrew.com. Be blessed and be a blessing. Until next time.